and welcome to Untold, the podcast where we go behind the scenes and uncover the untold stories of food and drink businesses. I'm Harry, founder of The Savourist.
I'm Mariana, founder of Hullabaloo. We want to uncover some of the stories from founders and business leaders that wouldn't normally be told. Everyone talks about the positives, the new launches, the NPD.
We want to hear about the not so great things, the nitty gritty and the emotional toll this can have on mental health. Over the next few months, we're going to be talking to founders and business owners about their untold stories. Hello and welcome to Untold, the podcast where we go behind the scenes to discover the untold food and drink stories about times and stories that where things haven't gone quite to plan. Today we have a super exciting guest. We're back for episode 8.
I hope that's accurate.
It is now, Mariana. It is now.
There we go. Say it with confidence and I'll believe it.
Great confidence. Our guest today is John Stapleton. He doesn't need much introduction in our industry. He founded and exited three fantastic brands, including household names such as Little Dish and New Covent Garden Soup. These days, John is an active investor, non-exec, and a mentor to an impressive portfolio of startups. I think both of us have heard John speak at numerous industry events. John regularly shares great insights on his LinkedIn feed. And a while ago, I spotted a post talking about the need to learn from failures and thought I would reach out. And I'm so pleased we can make this work. So welcome, John.
Hey, wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me on. And I hope I can provide some insight and input to all the people who are listening.
Super, really excited to hear your story. To kick off, could you please introduce yourself and your career very briefly?
Of course. And by the way, it is St. Patrick's Day, and whenever you ask an Irishman to speak for 2 minutes, you get 20 minutes. So please jump in and stop me. But listen, you already introduced me really, really well. There's only one thing to correct you on, and that is the middle business. Didn't work out so well, and I guess that's what we're going to maybe talk a little bit about in terms of learning from failure. But very quickly, way back in 1987, set up New Covent Garden Soup Company with a guy called Andrew Palmer. It was Andrew's idea, and I got to meet him, and we thought, you know, there's so many questions here. The only way we're going to answer any of them is by doing it. So we did. So we launched Fresh Soup in a Carton back in 1987, and I suppose to a certain extent the rest is history. But we sold the business in 1998. To a company called Daniels. We got a roughly about 20 million revenue at that stage. So it was a nice sort of exit, but also a really interesting 10-year white knuckle ride, learning all about fresh soup and about business and frankly about myself as well. And then I went quickly to the States, rather very quickly. I was off to the States immediately almost to do more or less the same thing there, which is bringing fresh soup in a carton to the US market. And you would have thought that, you know, if anybody knows anything about fresh soup, I would have done at that stage. But it didn't work. We got a lot right, but it ultimately didn't work. And that was a great learning experience. Really, really was. I learned a lot there. I think people say, you know, you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. That is certainly the case for me. Although I learned a huge amount at New Covent Garden. And then the other side of the sandwich, if you say I've got like, you know, a failure sandwich between two successes, was a company called Little Dish. And Little Dish was all about healthy, convenient, tasty meals for kids, originally meals and then subsequently snacks as well. And so we set that up in 2006, I think, and then sold it in 2017. So it took quite a while, but again, a happy end. Roughly got to about 15, 16 million revenue at that retail revenue at that stage. So that's like a potted history of what I've been doing, I suppose, for the first 30 years of my 35 years career. And since then, I've got many fingers and many pies helping small businesses grow, either as an investor or as an advisor or as a mentor. I do that directly with a whole range of businesses based in the UK, typically around the London area or in Dublin as well. I'm involved with Board BIA, the Irish Food Board, on their entrepreneurial programs. They are getting investors ready getting entrepreneurs ready for investment. And we're looking at doing other things in Ireland as well. And we got a business called Mission Ventures based in London, which kind of does what I do on a much more formal basis. Kind of, you know, we build challenger brands in the food and drink space and many other things too, I guess. But that probably does for the moment in terms of an introduction. So food and drink, brands, lots of ups and downs. Hopefully we can talk some more about some of those.
That's amazing. And that definitely was about 2 minutes. So well done. I think
that's going to say, bang on.
2 minutes.
Bang on. And what an introduction.
Yeah. So as you know, our theme on Untold is sort of uncovering untold stories. So stories about things that didn't quite go to plan, and talking about the emotional side of that for the benefit of helping people out there who are going through something difficult at the moment. So we'd really love to hear from you about a story. I believe it's about your middle business, about a time when things went wrong and how you dealt with that.
Yeah, I don't want to suggest that nothing ever went wrong with the other two businesses too. I mean, it's all very well and good, and they're all in the past, and they all feel like successes. Well, they are successes, but certainly through them, it didn't feel like a success. Certainly not all of the time. There are lots of difficulties with getting New Covent Garden launched. We spent 18 months trying to get soup into cartons. You wouldn't think it was that difficult, but it really was very difficult for a whole bunch of reasons. And that's another story. And Little Dish as well, that you might think I've set up two businesses already, 15, 20 years under my belt. I should know everything about business, but you never know everything about business. And a lot of things that we did then were mistakes and errors and failures too. I guess so. The easiest way to kind of encapsulate and bring it all together in one story or one example is the middle business. You're right. Is Glencoe Foods. We called Glencoe Foods, and it was basically, if you call New Covent Garden Soup Company a success, then Glencoe Foods was a failure because it just didn't work, and we had to pull out. And the two businesses were very similar. Both were a soup in a carton. New Covent Garden in the UK and Glencoe Foods in the US. And of course. I think people sometimes underestimate the differences between the UK and the US. I think one person is usually credited to Mark Twain, but I'm not quite sure if it ever was, but said, the US and the UK are two countries divided by a common language. And I think there's there's so much truth in that. We on both sides of the pond, we sort of assume that because we speak English and because the culture is, at least on the surface, very similar, then everything else, is very straightforward and we just do there what we did here and vice versa. And it's often not the case. And to be fair with Glencoe Foods, we got a lot right in the US business, really. We did some really good preparation. We actually, would you believe, flew soup out to the States in Virgin Airlines. We made the soup in London and put it on a few pallets and sent it to the airport, and they flew it out to San Francisco and to New York. Right. Yeah. So we had a master plan in the Bay Area selling the soup. So we really got to understand a lot about the US consumer and the pallets and the preferences. And we increased the shelf life. That was something that was obvious. And we resourced really well. And we hired some good people. And we raised about $2 million. So, we did a lot right. But fundamentally, it didn't work. And ultimately, we had to close the business, 4 years into trading. So that was, that was Glencoe Foods in a nutshell.
Can you just tell us a bit more about the decisions leading to the closure of Glencoe? Yes.
Of course. It's always very interesting when you're going back in hindsight, trying to think through what went wrong or what could have been done better, and also trying to put your finger on what the key issues were. Because at the time, everything is mixed up together, and it's easy to say I could have done this and I should have done that. But having said all that, the thing about it is we had customers, and that's kind of frustrating. We had enough customers to be encouraging. We just needed more customers. So it wasn't a complete dead loss. It wasn't a complete failure. And we were quite encouraged and we had a great launch. And I guess the question is, why didn't it work? And it's, clearly, too long to explain everything, but there's probably five or six things if I think about it up front. One, we built a factory and we probably shouldn't have. We probably didn't need to. We probably could have and should have outsourced manufacturing. That would have been a great advantage because we spent a lot of money building a factory, and then we had huge overheads later on that we had to all offset, and that put pressure on building volume. But we had a factory in London because we had to have it. Nobody made fresh soup then, but some people did make fresh soup in the States, and we probably could have worked with them, and that would have been less of a millstone around our neck in hindsight. And the other big thing, I suppose, was also that we couldn't get our rate of sale moving quickly enough. And we ended up chasing volume to fill our factory. We're based on the West Coast, and we ended up in distributing into Chicago and distributing also back to the East Coast. And there is no localized chilled distribution system in the US like there is in the UK. And it became very difficult and very inefficient. And, you know, there was no, it just wasn't as easy by any means as we thought it might have been. And also the US consumers, you know, they've got different, they've got, you know, the UK consumer base we knew pretty well. You know, there's a price, convenience, quality equation or triangle, if you like, which we knew well. And the US consumer is different. Convenience is much, much higher in terms of prioritizations. I guess the final thing really, which put the cherry on top, was a company came knocking at our door very, very early, really premature, wanting to buy us. Best Foods wanted to buy us. They own the Knorr or Knorr brand, and they wanted to bring Knorr into chilled in the States. And we were very circumspect about that. We thought they were trying to understand our technology. And in the end, actually, they were very genuine. But it got us very distracted. We spent a lot of time talking to them about selling the business, and it really was a premature conversation. We weren't ready to sell the business. We needed to drive our business and grow our business. And at the 11th hour of doing a deal, and we almost had a deal done, but as you know, a deal is never done until it's done, Unilever bought Best Foods. And Unilever said, stop all M&A, and certainly stop all M&A with assets attached to it. In other words, factories. You know, they reckoned Best Foods had enough factories already. And of course, we had a factory. And even if we hadn't, you know, once momentum is stopped in a deal, it's very difficult to get it going again. And anyway, it didn't work. So we spent, you know, soup is very seasonal. We spent about like 12 or 14 months being distracted with that process. And we missed two winter seasons, really, in terms of being focusing on the business. So lots of lessons in hindsight, but they're probably the main reasons why the business actually didn't work. And then we, of course, had to go and deal with that.
But what led you to then decide, if we go back to that time, that you don't want to, you know, try something else or whatever? Like, what was the key driver there? I mean, I understand that the business wasn't working, but what was kind of the final decision point there? Because that must be quite a difficult decision to make. As you said yourself, you've got customers still liking the product and whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, the going back and explaining, you know, that whole 5 years in 20 minutes or whatever it is, you know, doesn't do it justice, of course. But you got to distill out the main issues. And of course, you know, we definitely didn't want to shut down. It was the last thing we wanted to do. So we kept trying to put it off, or kept trying to rescue, or kept trying to find a, you know, slightly different strategy, or pivoting, or understanding what wasn't working so well and changing it. So it wasn't like an overnight decision by any means. Yeah. And we had shareholders that were reasonably supportive up to a point, up to the end. And so, you know, we were supported, I guess, to do what we thought was the right thing, but just couldn't make it work. And the thing about it is, of course, you know, it's like, you know, I talk a lot about adversity and, you know, embracing adversity. Mm. And adversity at Glencoe, you know, took many, many forms. You know, kind of, I suppose, three or four things I can think of. Managing shareholders' expectations is one, because, you know, I personally brought a lot of shareholders to the business. I was the guy who had come out of the successful UK business and gone to the States and said, I know all about fresh soup, and we need to do things differently here, but this is what we need to do differently, and come on me with you know, on my entrepreneurial journey, number two. So you know, you bring people along on your own belief and your justification and trust, and when you let down shareholders like that, their expectations, you know, it strikes home, and it's a very personal thing. And then, of course, the other issue was laying off employees. You know, it was quite a traumatic experience there. You know, the plant was quite capital intense. So we didn't have that many people. But those we had, we knew very well. I knew very well. I actually had trained them on the equipment because I knew the equipment, you know, intimately from the UK. So I worked very closely with them, and I knew them, and I knew their families, and used to go for drinks with them. And that's, you know, that's a quite a difficult situation to deal with, to have to say it's over. Mm-hmm. And going through chapter 11 as well, you know, dealing with creditors and dismantling the whole business apparatus, which was left in shatters when you know, we had to walk away, and selling the equipment and trying to do the right thing for creditors. All that was incredibly difficult and energy sapping and hugely emotional. And it was, you know, I mean, without a shadow of a doubt, it was the most significant knockback of my career. And one which had the most pronounced and lasting repercussions, if you like. And you know, frankly, though, I think the detail of what went wrong isn't the issue. The issue more so is learning from what went wrong. Yeah. Because that's where the benefit lies, you know. So you know, failure hurts like hell. I think that's a big lesson I learned, if I didn't know it already. And it's not a great place to be, but it's a really good place to have been, because it makes you want to never be there again, right? So you do everything you possibly can to never be there again. And okay, so you know, the business lessons of what I learned was, you know, maybe we should have outsourced, and maybe, you know, we shouldn't have been distracted by Best Foods and all the rest of it. But the real lesson was, well, was much more to do, you know, a personal lesson and how you deal with failure and how you hopefully see the good in it and try to make it work for you the next time around.
Mm. And on that note, sort of on the more personal side, if you could go back, is there, you know, anything you wish you would have known, or how did you manage those emotions around the personal bits?
That's very interesting too, because I think a lot of times the there's a delay, you know. I mean, entrepreneurs are great at being, you know, being resilient and tenacious and dealing with problems. And I guess that's how they feel like they should define themselves a lot of the time. So in the thick of it, you're on an adrenaline rush, whether it's a, you know, an opportunity or a positive, or you're dealing with a problem or a challenge or adversity. And no matter which it is, like, you're on this adrenaline rush. At the time, you don't feel, you just feel consumed, sure, and maybe exhausted. You don't feel any of the effects of any of that till much later. Mm. And I think, you know, when certainly from my point of view, when you're dealing with failure, you certainly should. And let's call this the biggest failure that I had to deal with. You need to figure out what happened, right? You definitely do. What went wrong and what your role in that was. But I don't think you need to make it, well, you certainly do not need to make it a protracted post-mortem, because that doesn't do any good. You know, it's quite difficult, of course, easier said than done, because your head are full of questions. Your head is full of questions. And it's a lot of time about not just the business and your decisions, but about yourself and your own capability. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the great benefits of failure is that you learn a lot about yourself and you learn a lot about how you deal with pressure and how you deal with adversity. And it's really difficult to be subjective about yourself by definition, but you have to kind of find a way to listen to yourself and be aware of how you're feeling and understand that feeling low is actually good to experience it, you know, because you can pick on from there, type of thing. And you know, I touched on this earlier, but, you know, personally, after New Covent Garden, to an extent, I thought I knew everything. And, you know, I don't mean about like everything, but certainly not about business and about at least about fresh soup. And what was I doing? I was setting up a second company in fresh soup. So the Glencoe experience brought me down to earth with a bang. And it brought quite a bit of readjustment. And I believe that this resulted in at least a little bit of humility, which I hope then has become an asset. But of course, I only figured this out long afterwards. I was well back. I was back in Europe. I live in Germany these days. We came back from the States. My wife is German. And so I was well past all of that before I kind of figured a lot of this out. But I think the thing is that, you know, also having post-rationalized all of that, I think the other thing is not to beat yourself up too much. Mm. Because, you know, when you think about it, you got to put it in context. There's loads of examples of, you know, back to that quote about the UK and the US being divided by a common language. You know, a lot of examples of successful British and Irish companies not making it work in the US, you know, Tesco with Fresh and Easy and Greencore, they expanded hugely in the States, reasonably successful for a while, but then pulled out. You know, these, you know, we're in good company if it didn't work in the States for us. But that's scant, that's not really a silver lining. But at the same time, you don't want to constantly beat yourself up, you know, year in, year out about something that happened quite a while ago. I guess I'd summarize it by saying that, you know, the Glencoe experience taught me a lot. Mm. And, you know, I needed to understand how it affected me as a person in terms of self-motivation and self-esteem and how do I define myself almost to myself. Mm. And ultimately, the need to prove to myself that I could do it all over again. And that's ultimately where the you know, the motivation and the need to do little dish came from. I had to prove to others, I'm sure, but mostly to myself, that it wasn't a flash in the pan, that, you know, everything that went wrong at Glencoe, and some of it went really right, but everything that went wrong wasn't my fault. And you know, New Covent Garden Soup Company wasn't a success despite me, because, you know, your mind plays tricks on you when you're in a situation like that. So I needed to go and prove it to myself, particularly, that I could do it again. And that's why I wanted to and did do Little Dish.
Right. Did you take some time off in between the two to kind of go through that process?
Yeah, I did take some time off. And the thing about it was that it wasn't so obvious to me at the time, because I had moved back. Well, the Americans would say I moved back to Europe. But, you know, I had moved from London to San Francisco, to California, lived there for 5 years almost, and then moved to Munich, to where I live now. So there was a whole kind of distraction of, moving again and getting used to a new culture, a new language, a new world, a new experience, and then figuring out what I wanted to do next. So there was a whole bunch of excitement and upside and uncertainty, but in a positive sense. So it wasn't like I had to force myself to take some time off. I had a whole bunch of new things going on. I was definitely taking time off from work or from the food industry, certainly, of looking at a whole bunch of other things. And gradually, because all my contacts really were either in the UK or in the States, for a professional contacts at any rate, for all the obvious reasons, I kept being drawn back to both. And it became over time more difficult to be drawn back to the States because it's such a distance. And we weren't all working through online media like we are now. So California is a long way away. You don't go there for a few days to answer a few questions about a project. So the automatic default was going to London on a regular basis. So I reacquainted myself with everything that was going on in the UK and began to think of a new project. And it very quickly gathered momentum. You know, it was if you think back, it was in the middle of when Jamie Oliver was in his first crusade about the health of the nation's food, and in particular child school dinners, etc. So you had a whole bunch of, you know, background noise about it. It was a very topical issue. People were talking about kids' diets and they didn't even have kids themselves. So it was an obvious time to do this. And so I looked closely at this and met my business partner then. I've set up these three businesses with each time with the co-founders. We've done it together. And we both had the same idea, you know, simultaneously almost. And then it gathered momentum. And then before we knew where we were setting up Little Dish. So that's how it happened.
Brilliant.
Amazing. I think there's a couple of bits there that stand out for me. And I think the first one is when you speak about sort of wanting to go again and proving to yourself, it's very much kind of like the demons are within yourself. And I think where a lot of people maybe have some failures, especially in the early days of starting a business, is wanting to prove to others that what they're doing is the right thing, rather than having the confidence in themselves to know that what they're really trying to do is prove to themselves about what they can do. And I think there's a really interesting point to come out there, because you kind of almost have to go through that journey of hardship to know that actually the kind of gratification is the wrong word, but to have the kind of support and the fan base of other people knowing that you're doing well really doesn't matter when everything doesn't work out, and actually the only person that does matter is yourself. And I think that's a really fascinating one for our sort of listeners to take away. And then the other thing as well is just that constant battle that brands have and founders have or teams have the kind of fascination with the US. I know that there's a few brands at the moment that have gone over there and are doing a good job. And I know from sort of previous experience in my previous job that what a crazy market it is, and how it doesn't just translate. I remember my uncle saying to me that the US is like the Premier League and that the UK market is a little bit like seven aside. And you kind of have that, like the aspiration is always to go into the US, but the really interesting thing I took there is kind of the right timing, making sure that the product fit. Like, there isn't just, as you say, like there isn't just that kind of naturally, like, well, let's just go and do it in the US. It's a very, very different market.
Yeah, I mean, picking up on the second point first, you're absolutely right, and I think we underestimate how different it can be because we're drawn towards the similarities. You know, the similarities are easy to identify. And it's like, yeah, if the US, although, you know, the US could be the Premier League, certainly in terms of scale and opportunity, it's just a huge market. But really, it's not a market. It's not a homogeneous market. It's there are lots of different local markets or regional markets at any rate. You know, we were in California, and we looked at it hard, actually, because our plan was to have two factories, to have two centers of the business, West Coast and East Coast. And we looked long and hard at whether we should go East Coast, West Coast first. Because I mentioned we flew soup out all the time, and for a good 8-9 months we flew soup out to both California, San Francisco, and to New York, and it was a close call, I suppose, really, whether do we do something on the East Coast first or the West Coast. And the thing that pinned it for that cast in favor of going to California was we thought there's so many benefits of both, but really there are probably more early adopters in California. And it's interesting that the Tesco with their retail business went to California first as well. But having said of that, you know, there's a huge Latino population. They have different palate preferences, and you go to the Midwest and you go to Chicago, and you know, back and forth, there's a whole lot of different differences. So you really have to understand all those different markets. It's kind of like Europe as a market, lots of different markets, maybe apart from the language difference, although there are languages too. So it's, I think it's treating the US like as a homogeneous market is one probably error. But also, I think it's really a question of really understanding the target market, which we felt we actually did. And I think, you know, if we had understood though the triangular relationship between quality, price, and convenience, quality, health, and convenience within a price context, we might have done it differently. I might have had a better chance of getting it right from the start. We were gradually getting it right. We were gradually getting it better. And that was really frustrating thing about it. I thought if we could raise another chunk of money to give us another 18 months of runway, we would have been able to gather through and break through and generate some momentum on the rate of sale. But of course, every entrepreneur I know says that. So you gotta have a touch of the other. That's always the way. I figured out what we did wrong. Great, I'm gonna put it right, but I need another 18 months to prove it. And the other thing was, actually, we already had that 18 months, but we had wasted it because we had become distracted with the Best Foods sale process that never was. So, you know, we only had ourselves to blame, really, you could say. And all of that, of course, is what gives you sleepless nights and think, oh, shoulda, coulda, woulda. But in the end, it wasn't. And you have to kind of think, all right, I understand it. It wasn't great. I learned from it. And now I put a line under it and I moved on. And your first point, which was like, you know, this whole thing about overcoming adversity it's interesting because we think we learn everything, you know, from the first 5 years or the first 10 years, and then we know enough to be able to say, we're not going to make those mistakes again. But we end up making them all the time, and we end up making them in different guises. We don't necessarily recognize they're the same mistake because it gets presented in a different way. And you know, the other point about, you know, I think you didn't quite mention imposter syndrome, but I think a lot of people think that, you know, they don't deserve to be, especially entrepreneurs. You know, I remember I certainly had a bit of that in the early years at New Covent Garden, because I studied science in university, which is great, you know, but you know, it didn't prepare me for a life as an entrepreneur by any means. You know, science teaching is all about first principles and theory and proving it and taking your time and working through a lot of data, step by step, agonizingly working up until you understand something and then testing the hell out of it. And in entrepreneurial world, you don't have time for any of that. You have to go with insight and seat of the pants and a bit of creative approach to what you think you know, and then say, oh, this is what I know, and now I'm going to do it by proving. Now I'm going to prove it by doing it. And of course people fall over, but they pick themselves up quickly and make a pivot or change to what they've done before. And that's a completely different world to being a scientist. So I always felt in the early couple of years that, crikey, how did I get here? How did I get to be the person to deciding on this particular issue? You know, I'm not qualified for any of this, but of course nobody is ever qualified for any of this in an entrepreneurial world. I think the only thing you got to do is realize to yourself that you're the best person in the room right now to make this decision, and that's all that matters. And make the decision and move on. And if it's slightly wrong, well, just correct it and keep moving on.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Absolutely. So just to sort of wrap up, is what advice would you give somebody who's going through something similar in terms of somebody who's just decided that their business is not going to work out? I mean, what would you say to them?
Wow. I mean, every business is different. So all sorts of circumstances are going to be different. And so any one thing you say, you could say, but. So big picture, I honestly think the advice is don't be fearful of failure, you know? And by the way, I'm not suggesting you can make a career out of failure, right? Because you can't. but failure does make you stronger. You know, you learn a lot about yourself. I mentioned you learn a lot about how you react to pressure and how you react to adversity and how you react to difficult circumstances. And once you know yourself better, then you can rely on yourself an awful lot more in future, you know, number one. And you know, I actually now look for people when I'm recruiting, for example, or when I'm helping businesses that I'm involved with recruit, for people who have something on their CV where they've had the opportunity to make mistakes. And then they can also demonstrate what they've learned from it, type of thing. Because what I hate, you know, I don't think it's possible to have a CV of glowing successes one after the other. There's got to be something in there which you screwed up on or didn't do quite right. And not just kind of wrote it off, but then listen to yourself and understood why it happened and what you learned from it. And I think this is a problem that you get, I think, in larger organizations. And I've never really worked in a large organization, but my observation of it is that, you know, one of my colleagues once told me this kind of anecdote. He says, okay, if you've got five corporate frogs sitting on a log and five of them decide to jump off, how many are still sitting on the log? And the answer is five. Because there's a big difference between deciding to and actually doing. And if you're a corporate frog, the chances are you're still deciding. Whereas if those five frogs were entrepreneurial frogs, they probably would have been gone long ago and you know, maybe got into some difficulty and swum across and maybe some alligators or I don't know what be around that they hadn't figured out about. But in a scramble, they would have maybe, you know, at least four of them made it to the edge of the pond and scampered off, and maybe one would come a cropper. But that's the nature of entrepreneurs, isn't it? It's like make a decision and go for it, but based on some sort of justification. I'm not saying willy-nilly, I've no idea, I'm just going to do something. I think, you know, your decisions need to be based on logic, but you're not going to have all the information on every single parameter or every single variable about what could go wrong. And that's, yeah, I think the corporate world comes in. They try to analyze things a lot, and 3 years later they bring something to market when by then the entrepreneur has done it a few times and actually has something that works. So I do think there's a lot of there of that in terms of learning from failure. But the other thing is, I think in the life of an entrepreneur, you know, adversity is such an obvious part of life for entrepreneurs. You know, we're constantly trying things for the first time, or swimming against the tide, or uprooting trees, or crashing through walls, and all that crazy stuff. You're basically being disruptive, right? And that means for me that we put ourselves purposefully in the way of adversity. And I think that's only to be expected, that we, you know, we experience resistance then at every turn. Because if we didn't want that, by the way, we could have taken the road less traveled, the road more traveled, and just gone and got a job, right? But if we're doing things differently and we're being disruptive or we're being a challenger brand, then we're going to get a lot of resistance along the way. Somebody once said, hopeless on quotes, but, and I don't go in for quotes that much, but a guy, I think is called Lou Holtz, I may be wrong. He said, show me somebody who's done anything worthwhile and I'll show you somebody who's had to overcome adversity. And I really like that because I think it's so true. And I think the opposite is also true, by the way. If you don't experience adversity or enough adversity, you're not putting yourself out there enough. And that's kind of like, you know, playing it safe. And quite frankly, whoever achieved anything new or innovative or successful by playing it safe. Yeah. So I think when adversity knocks, it's not a great place to be and you'd rather not be there, but it's not about what happens to you like at the time, because that's where the pain is coming from. It's about what you do about it, where the benefit comes from. So my message, I suppose, in wrapping up is embrace adversity, because it shows you're onto a good thing and you learn from it and you'll be a better person and you'll probably succeed as a result.
Love it.
Absolutely amazing. Do you have anything further to add, Harry?
No, I think it's been absolutely fantastic, and some really sort of tangible takeaways there as well for our listeners. I think it's been fascinating and incredibly brave being able to kind of open up and talk about it. And what as you know, sort of here we are all about that side of business and kind of the realities behind the glitz and glamour of the LinkedIn posts and the social media and the kind of brilliant grocer and press articles and all that sort of jazz. And it's really nice to sort of dive in to those stories with some of your experience. So thank you so much for sharing so openly and honestly.
Not at all. I mean, I don't know it any other way. I can't make it up because what's the point? And there's so much stuff that went on. there's so much, so much anecdote and stories and examples that went on. So why not, you know, why not tell it how it is? And I think you know, people need to believe that they're not on their own, right? People need to think that, you know, you don't just hear about the successes, which is great, and you think, oh crikey, that's just not for me, or I'll never get there. Whereas, you know, it's easy to think as an entrepreneur that life's out to get you because you get so many knockbacks. And all I'd say is, yeah, that's just the way it is. It was exactly the same for me, and it was all the way through. And it will be that way when you set up your own business. Don't think it won't. But that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing, certainly. And it's life, and everybody has to go through it, and you're not alone. So I think sharing those little stories sometimes make people, at least that happened to somebody else. Well, it does. Every day, all day. It happens to people all the time.
It's so true. So true. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. Amazing, amazing discussion.
Oh, great. Listen, I'm delighted you got something out of that. And hopefully you can piece it all together into something that makes sense for a 20 minutes slot.
Of course. Absolutely.